The one with the president's son and the prime minister's son getting together. What the hell was that called?
Oh my God.
I have not seen that one, no.
Whatever.
Hello, and welcome to Expected Own Goals Preview Edition. I'm your host, Eric Morgan, a former soccer writer for Howler and Deadspin, and boy, do we have some exciting news today. Evan?
I am Evan Davis, analytics columnist for Equalizer Soccer. This is a very exciting day. First of all, it's the beginning of NWSL season preview week, so we are going to be bombarding your feed with previews of all 14 teams. We're going to be going in-depth. We're going to be getting into the weeds tactically with data. We're going to be having a lot of great guests all throughout the week and culminating on Friday in time for the NWSL Challenge Cup between Gotham and San Diego. And the reason we are so excited to be launching NWSL Season Preview Week today in this forum is that we are now the official women's soccer podcast partner of American Soccer Analysis.
Woohoo!
And if you are listening to us in the American Soccer Analysis pod feed, you know that already. But if you are not, please welcome one of the hosts of the ASA show and the guy who helped make all of this happen, none other than Mr. Kieran Doyle Davis. Kieran, welcome. What's up, partner?
Welcome. Or I should be welcomed. Yeah, we're super excited to have Expected Own Goals on the ASA feed. I think we've been talking about trying to expand the women's coverage at ASA for a long time. And I think ASA is one of the only places on the internet where you can find really detailed women's data. Really, it's there and FBref, and that's the only two places. And I think it kind of listening to you guys pod and the people you bring on and the topics you talk about, it was kind of a no-brainer when this came up. So we are really excited to have all of us come on the pod, or to have you guys on our feed, and for the odd ASA person to make a guest appearance.
Yeah, the odd ASA person. I think we'll be hearing a lot from both you and Ariana Cascone going forward, Kieran.
Absolutely.
Really, really exciting for us. So yeah, if you are listening to us on the regular Expected Own Goals feed, you do not have to do a thing. You will still be getting every episode every Tuesday morning during the season. And if you are listening to us on the ASA show feed, I'm going to start this up top. Please follow us on social media at XOwnGoals. That's the letter XOwnGoals. We are on Blue Sky. We went a little bit viral by making fun of Carly Lloyd last night, which is very fun. If you think we have an own goal, please email us at expectedowngoals@gmail.com. That's the letter expectedowngoals@gmail.com. So today we are beginning NWSL Season Preview Week with the two brand spanking new expansion squads to the league, Bay FC in the Utah Royals, two teams that are super interesting for very different reasons.
Kieran, we often open with a question that is not necessarily related or a common interest question.
Can I open with a different question?
Sure.
Yes.
Evan, how did it feel to watch the world's best goalkeeper, Kaylin Sheridan, make the most scandalous save perhaps in women's Gold Cup history?
What I love about you Canadians is that you always play to type.
Yeah.
You know? If it's not Sink, it's Kaylin. And no, I mean, listen, I think that Canada showed their true colors against Costa Rica,
which is not very good.
Yeah, they are a grinding, grubby, miserable team to watch, and it's going to be a really rough game in San Diego for the semifinal against the U.S.
I would describe it as a true gold medal performance.
Oh, God.
Exactly. Eric, what is our question this week?
Because I feel like what we're about to discuss is a tale of two very different expansion teams, what is a piece of art or movie that everyone hates that you love, and what is a piece of art or movie that everyone loves that you don't really care for?
Oh, wow. I don't know if I can answer both. I don't know if I can answer both with the detail that question deserves. But I will say a thing that I love that most people hate are like terrible Amazon Prime romantic comedies.
Oh, ooh. So good.
Like I like that movie Upgraded. Like that's objectively a terrible movie, and I watched it and I loved it. So yeah, horrific streaming platform romantic comedies.
It's a great question, Eric, and it ties rather beautifully into what we do in analyzing soccer, because Emmy Award winner Brett Goldstein, writer, producer, and star of Ted Lasso, has his own podcast called Films to be Buried With, and he basically has constructed a Bernard Pivot Inside the Actor's Studio-esque questionnaire for his guests around movies. And one of the questions is, what is the movie you love that everyone hates? And then reverses it. So it's all of a piece. My movie that I love that everyone hates is Holiday in Handcuffs, which is an ABC Family holiday movie starring Melissa Joan Hart and Mario Lopez that I think is just so goddamn funny. And everyone looks at me like I have three heads, but the jokes are just absolutely superlative. Timothy Bottoms is in it, plays the grumpy dad. Marky Post, may she rest in peace, is the mom. It's a great. I watch it every holiday season. Always watch it with somebody who's never seen it before. And I knew that the woman I am currently with was the one for many reasons, but the big one is that she thought it was pretty funny too. And the movie that I hate that everyone loves, I don't know, probably any Ingmar Bergman movie that you can pick out of a list.
I've got a good answer to this now. I've dwelled on it. I don't know if everyone loves it so much as thinks it's good, but Avatar, I hated that movie.
Sure. Yeah, I don't like Avatar very much either. I get it.
It was not an enjoyable film to watch.
Bloated nonsense.
Yeah, the one that I always get the most gasps about is I hate The Dark Knight. I think it is nihilistic garbage.
That's gasp-worthy.
And a thing that everybody hates that I love, I really love Pain and Gain.
Oh, that movie rules.
Yeah, but it's Michael Bay, and that's a person that I don't even think you're allowed to like. So
that's Michael Bay's best film.
So I have said Chris Nolan down, Michael Bay up, which is one of the most incoherent film opinions I think a person can have. Anyway.
We want to talk about players that certain coaches love and everyone else seems to, well, hate might be a strong word. Let's kick it off with the Utah Royals.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
A team that once existed under different ownership and under a very different structure has been reborn under the Real Salt Lake aegis. And that's my opinion.
No,
about the Utah Royals. It's an incredible, it's hard to be an expansion team in any league, in any sport of any gender. But I think what we do here is we talk about process, we talk about tactical philosophies, we talk about bringing players in that data can support. And there seems to be a philosophy here with Utah. And I just don't think it's going to be an especially successful one. Eric, do you agree?
I feel like this iteration of Utah is like a clone gone terribly wrong. It's a team that, to me, feels like someone just decided to never take a look at a single piece of data. The only thing I can say for them is that they are young.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have a lot more beyond, like, they are young and Allie Centner's very good. I fear for them.
And they're not, like, that young, right? Like, there's a lot of 25, 26-year-olds, but there's, like, a handful of 23, a handful of 21. Like, it's not like they have Sophie Smith.
No.
Or like Trinity Rodman, who were like breaking through at like 1920.
Yeah.
Right. And like, as much as we, as there are limitations because of the college system and like you're getting comparatively few 19-year-olds breaking through, it is a meaningful difference in terms of like Allie Centner is like the really like only legit young player.
I take a look at this and I sort of wonder if they wouldn't have just been better served by holding an open trial of BYU,
Utah State,
Utah Valley, Weber State, Utah. Like, if they just hadn't invited every college player from the greater Salt Lake area and just said, hey, we're just going to take the best of you. Like, it, first off, the roster kind of looks like that. And second off, I was at the draft, and when Brecken Mozingo was taken, the question was, like, what's the best thing about being taken by Utah? And it was like, my commute's going to be really good. That's barely paraphrasing. And I know it was meant as this cute statement, but it was just like, oh, my God.
So the philosophy of this team can be best summarized by the woman who's going to be the head coach, Amy Rodriguez, who was hired now almost a year ago because this team has been in the works for quite some time. I think I'm not the only one. Many people in the media have joked about the way that she has framed her and sporting director Kelly Cousins' recruiting strategy, which is a lot of hard work, grit, players who know how to win, players who have won before. And I stopped myself and I thought, are we exaggerating? Because it's not as though she has made a lot of public statements. You know, she did a quick interview on television around the expansion draft, had a couple of quotes about Mazingo and Centner during the college draft. Her media day press conference about a month ago is available on YouTube to watch. And no, we're not being unfair. Rodriguez is bringing the energy that she had as a player to what she is going to be as a head coach, it seems. She's not dumb.
No.
Like, she was a pretty tactically sophisticated player in addition to being a great athlete. But there seems to be a series of priorities in place with Utah. And Kelly Cousins herself is an ex-player, too. So it's not as though the front office is serving as a check on what Rodriguez is thinking or wants the team to look like. In fact, I'm sure that Cousins was hired because Rodriguez was already there as the head coach. Like, they're very much working in sync. But and we should also acknowledge, like, it's like Sandy, Utah is not the attractive free agent big international transfer destination that the San Francisco Bay Area is. You know, like, in addition to not necessarily having an ownership group that wants to open up the checkbook, like, it's just going to be difficult to draw free agents to an environment like that. So they were always going to be running uphill a little bit, but that's when you have to figure out where market inefficiencies are and find players that might be offering something that other people aren't noticing. And we're going to break this projected 11 down one by one, but man, it's tough to see where that wrinkle is. And there are players in this lineup that I do like, you know, but they're not necessarily, like, on their own game changers if they do not have the players and a tactical system around them to make it all work.
Yeah, Kieran, Evan, go against type and tell me why there's a glimmer of hope in Utah. What do you squint at and see as, I understand the logic here and this could work?
Here's my, like, optimistic view. Mm. And sometimes I like, when we were prepping for the show, I was kind of looking at this and I was like, we all talked and, like, the tone is fairly negative. And I was like, okay, if I want to be the contrarian here, how am I going to do this? And there's a few things. So, like, first off, Daryl Morey is part of this ownership group.
Mm-hmm.
And he has been very public about what he thinks about soccer, in that the best way to play soccer from a budgetary perspective is you should kick the ball as far away from your net as fast as you can and go press people after you go do it. So he wants to play launch and squish like Brentford or like Barnsley in the men's English league. Nobody in NWSL really plays like that. It's a very transitional league, but there aren't a lot of teams who play
hit and hope. They don't do that.
Launch and squish. Yeah. Like, that's not really a thing in NWSL. So if I was to talk myself into this team, I would say, okay, you have a lot of players who can run.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you got a lot of athletes. You do not have any passing.
No.
And so to me, if I'm being really optimistic, the way I see it is, they have said passing is too expensive a skill to get for the market we are.
Hmm.
We cannot get, who we are going to talk about later, we cannot get Dana Castellanos, we cannot get Alex Loera, because they don't want to come here and we can't afford them. What we can get is a bunch of kids from Utah who are going to run. And do we curse on this? Are
oh,
we
yeah.
allowed curse?
Oh, yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah.
Like, who are going to go kick the shit out of you.
Right.
And you're going to kick the ball long and they're going to kick the shit out of you and they're going to press and go from there. And I think that is such a different way to play in NWSL that teams who have been very open about we want to play, so teams like the Spirit, teams like the Courage, teams like Bay, might have a little bit of trouble when Utah come and turn it into a mud fight.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, is the optimist case for Utah.
Right.
The Norwegian men's national team used this as a tactical approach for a long time, because the argument was essentially, we're a country of 4.5 million people. We just don't have the assets to do something other than very disruptive football. That argument made some sense to me when we were talking about a national team. That doesn't make any sense to me when you're playing in a league and have the same essential money to spend. It's not like they're stretching the budget.
Well, and
they have
more.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Because they're an expansion team. They have more.
The chips you were handed at the beginning of the game, why are you not using all of them, and why are you committing to a system that only peaks so high?
Yeah, I think where, like, my optimistic take falls down is like, in the men's game, if you are a New York Red Bull, in the global marketplace, you are a minnow.
Sure.
Utah are like the 15th richest women's club in the world.
You're not wrong.
You could go break the world transfer fee and it would not matter. This is the thing with NWSL is like, you are, the whole league is the 15 richest clubs. It's like Barcelona, Chelsea, Arsenal, maybe are competitive for that. Bayern, maybe. Lyon, maybe. But even these teams are, their owners are probably richer.
Yeah.
Maybe my optimistic take is that there is a very healthy amount of NWSL experience in the players who I think are probably going to make this 11, namely players like Paige Monahan and Ifeoma Onamonu, who have at times been productive in the NWSL. You know, Paige Monahan has been a little bit streaky of late. She had a really hot first half with Louisville last year and then really fell off the table after the World Cup break. Onamonu has been a very good striker, very good winger, rather, with Gotham, and just kind of caught the short end of the stick with injury and also not necessarily being the top option for Juan Carlos Amoros. So when Onamonu was on the field, like, she was pretty good last year. So if she can do that for 2,000 minutes, then maybe you can find a dribbly player who can, like, stretch play on the right side and open up room for either Michelle Vasconcelos or Hannah Bedford to run into and receive crosses. That's not the worst way to try and play, particularly if you're going to be really, really defensively stalwart and just screw up the opposition's attacking plan. But
are they going to be really defensively stalwart?
And that's the thing. I think that's the idea that they want to be, but...
Well, I just don't see it. I don't see it. And this is maybe where, like, a thing that I'm going to complain about for both of these teams is that we just don't know anything because these teams play all their games behind closed doors in Coachella Valley, and, like, you get maybe an Instagram stream from a supporters group. Like, that's the best you get.
Totally.
That's a relatively new policy in the league as well, to basically just shut the press and fans out of preseason.
And it's so MLS, which is like, and it's one of the things everybody hates about MLS. Like, just put the stream up. Everybody's going to, like, to pull the curtain back, this is how teams operate. If I'm playing Utah the first week, I am calling the teams Utah played in preseason. If I'm performance analyst Kieran, I'm calling the other performance analysts, or I'm Twittering the other performance analysts and saying, hey, can you give us video from your game against Utah? I'll give you video from our game against North Carolina.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's how it goes. They're seeing you anyways. So the only people who don't get to watch it are the fans. And you end up with podcasts like this where we're like, in my head, I'm like, well, they're going to play launch and squish because that's the only way that I can see them succeeding.
But you don't actually know.
But for all we know, they've played like super slow possession ball and they're going to kill games by having 80% and not doing anything with it. And like, we just don't know.
It raises the question of, if that was an approach, like, how would they go about doing it? So we started talking about the defense. It's a defense of a lot of backups.
Yeah.
You know, Mandy Haught ended up being the number one in Gotham because Abby Smith got injured. Kaylee Real was partnered with Naomi Gurman in San Diego because Abby Dahlkemper's back still wasn't healing as quickly as they wanted. Addison Merrick got a ton of minutes because Elizabeth Ball was hurt in Kansas City. You know, these are players who had, you know, if for whatever like level of experience that you might feel reassured by up front with players like Monahan and Onamonu, I don't have that same level of assurance on the other side, where even though Real got an entire season because Dahlkemper didn't come back until pretty late, it was Gurma that was keeping that central defense locked down. It wasn't Real. And Haught, you know, is not the same athlete that Abby Smith was, but was asked to play the same hyper-aggressive sweeper-keeper way that Abby Smith was asked to play, and it sometimes got a little gnarly, you know? You know, debate it as you will about whether or not her getting the red card at the end of the championship was an accident or smart strategy, given the timing of where things were in the game. It still happened, you know, and if it was an accident, that means, wow, you really just mistimed that challenge. So yeah, where's the solidity? Where's the stability? Who passes out of the back?
Oh my God.
You know, if that's like, if that's how you, if you have like 70% possession, you just want to strangle games that way. Are Kaylee Real and Addison Merrick the center backs to do it?
I mean,
no.
And then moving further up the field is Mikayla Clough, who was fine for Orlando. I think there's nothing really like negative to say about Mikayla Clough, but was there anything that was really like sparking Orlando to life from wire to wire? They had a good second half, but it really wasn't coming from Mikayla Clough. It was coming from other players. We don't really know what Agnes Nyberg is going to be in this environment, because she has not played even for one of the big five leagues in Europe. It's the most optimistic thing you can say off the forward line is, well, we don't know what might happen.
Do you think you guys follow hockey?
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, you know the Golden Knights when they did their expansion and they took, like, every second line player from every team?
Yeah.
Like, maybe that's what this is. It's like, yeah, we're going to get, like, their third center back and their third fullback and their third midfielder. And maybe it adds up to the sum of its parts, but I just don't think, like, I think given what we know about, like, what drives winning soccer, it is very difficult for me to see this team and say, like, you have utilized your resources appropriately. And maybe they have a bunch of stuff lined up for the summer and they're keeping the powder dry. It's possible. It wouldn't be the first time something like that's happened. But, like, what powder is coming to Utah?
Snow.
Other than some sweet, sweet aspen crisp.
Yeah.
We've actually discussed the Vegas Golden Knights a couple times, just as we've been trying to think of frameworks for very successful teams. But we're normally talking about it in relation to Bay, in terms of like really optimizing. But with Vegas, it was, we're just going to accumulate just a massive stockpile of great draft picks. Mm-hmm. And like just grab a handful of players we think are interesting and that we've done a fair amount of scouting on. And like, you know, if some of these guys pop off, that's great. And I think Vegas, who had a great game plan to succeed in the NHL over the first decade of their existence, ended up just like hitting the jackpot very early on. Oh man, that was unintentional, but real. That is so unique to the way in which a hockey team can be built to win.
Yeah.
A soccer team, you need 11 bets at once to hit, basically. You need like a hell of a parlay to land. Like, of all these gambles that they've taken on all these players, they need so many of these players to basically come in and work together well. And I look at the sum total of the talent and I say, even if it all does work together well, it's still not a very good team.
Yeah, Kieran, you made a really excellent point that maybe the strategy here is to take all of the second and third line, so to say, players from other good teams and see if you can make it work. But if I were Kelly Cousins and Amy Rodriguez and that was my approach, these are not the players I probably would have gone after.
This is kind of the awkward point of the expansion draft, and the draft is like,
yeah,
if you want to go get the actual best second best player, great, you can go do that. But if you also want to be an organization who has historically had some pretty nasty stuff going on, and now you want to be like, well, no, we want players who want to be here, those two strategies are fairly incompatible.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I think this is a thing where when we talk about the mechanisms of player acquisition in NWSL, like, these two things are starting to brush up against each other a lot more frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the case of Utah is another market that people don't really want to go. And now there's a few of those in NWSL that people don't want to go to. And there are a few markets that people do want to go to. And this is a thing in every sports league in North America, because it's like, whatever, you have Oklahoma City or whatever.
Right.
But in the other leagues, obviously the pay is enough that like you can squint and you'll go live in wherever you're going to live for 9 months of the year. We know in NWSL is not like that. But I think some of these teams like kind of have decisions to make of like, okay, do you want to respect the player's wishes and like, hey, I don't want to come to Utah, so we're not going to take you. Or are you just going to do it and live with it and be like, hey, look, we're going to be respectful about it, but we're going to make the best decision to win. And if you don't want to play here, like, we're going to trade you for the best assets we can get or whatever it is. And I think Utah are in this weird position where like they have a bunch of the second best 25 and 26 year olds, second best.
Mm.
Are they just asset hunting to see like, oh, if we turn this player into a starter, does another team see them as like oh, I didn't think like Onamanu could be like a real starting winger for us. Like, oh, maybe that's like the championship piece we need to get. Let's go give them our first round pick.
Yeah.
For example.
This is a like a diamonds in the rough theory, basically.
Yeah, maybe.
That if they've correctly identified a lot of these things, there's future value that exists with the squad.
Yeah, like Hannah Bedford is like a player yeah. who had like a vaguely interesting statistical profile in Portland, but very low minutes because of the nature of Portland's attack. Like, I think that's a really good gamble of like, yeah, let's get this player and like, we'll probably play her more than she deserves to play. And if it hits, we've gotten a starting striker in the league for nothing.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't hit, like, she's 26 and we can move on and do whatever we want with
right.
it.
Right.
I think to the small market point, what I think we've seen a lot in other North American sports and is if you build a culture of winning,
it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. I mean, I grew up in Portland, which is a big market team in the NWSL and a small market team in other sports. And the team regularly talked about just like trying to go find people who all they wanted to do was just like hang out in the gym and win games. And I think the same thing can be said about Oklahoma City and San Antonio. There are players that have gone there in the NBA and really been happy. I can totally imagine Utah being a place where if you got the right culture there, and I think that's why Amy Rodriguez is there. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to squint and imagine what a functional plan is, it's like we're going to build this mountain bastion where like you, the hardcore footballer, can come and join this Utah team where everyone works just as hard as you do and your game will be improved. And like there's a narrative you can pitch to players. I just don't think when I look at what they've assembled, that narrative is like compelling.
So let's talk about the roster and what potential formation might actually emerge, whether it's launch and squish or if it's strangle a game from the back, which it won't be. There are players that feel a fair bit obvious to be in the 11, but just because of the nature of the roster, it's not difficult to imagine that either through Rodriguez's own point of view or how players perform in preseason that this might get shaken up. But it feels to me that one of these Scandinavian central mids, either Nyberg or Federer, is probably going to be day one partnering with Michaela Clough and Ali Sentner sitting above them, and then using Monahan and either Onamanu or Mozingo as the wingers with Bedford up top and Pogacar, Delphave, American Real on the back line with Haught in goal. Does that feel right to you?
For me, yes.
I have such a hard time projecting a lineup because like
yeah.
past the front line plus like Sentner and like I think Mozingo probably gets in there.
Yeah.
Like, besides those players, do you feel that there is enough striation player to player that, like, you can tell me 100% that, like, Madison Pogark is going to start over Zoe Burns?
Not 100%, particularly in the way that Rodriguez has talked about the philosophy of the team. All she cares about is humbleness, hard work, and a winning mentality. Like, those things are her top priorities. So it would not shock me at all if she felt like there was one player who was, you know, running a little bit extra, throwing in for a bunch of extra tackles and screaming at her teammates, regardless of what she's actually producing. She'll be like, I like the cut of that girl's jib.
Yeah.
You know? And so, yeah, absolutely. And that also then throws the lineup into even more of a high variance outcome situation, because what the hell is Zoe Burns and what is she going to be?
The only thing that I'm fairly confident about saying is that they won't play a back three.
Yeah.
Right.
They just don't have the center back depth. Like, they really have like 2.5 center backs on the team.
That feels generous.
And they have so many of those, like, what is Emma Jeskaniak as a pro? What is Ali Sentner as a pro? Like,
Alyssa Melanson start?
Yeah, like
which we don't really know yet.
Like, what are they? Are they wingers? Are they tens? Are they eights? Are they nines? Like Jeskaniak is a weird one where like she bagged in college, but played like almost Corbin Albert-esque role that like doesn't exist in pro level soccer of like team in the backpack player where it's like just go find the ball and score. And I just don't know. They have a lot of like weird in between players. And normally I love weird in between players. It's like my favorite role. And like I'm gonna talk about how I love Dana Castellanos because she's like a weird in between player. But I think like the Utah weird in between players are like weird in between, like, how can you have a career in this league versus, like, how can you shine? How can you be a star? And it's like, if you don't find your weird in between, you're out of the league.
And the two potentials for stardom here are the two who we know nothing about in a professional context, and that's Ali Sentner and Breca Mazingo. Sentner feels locked on to be day one. Mazingo maybe less so, but that's only because she's got a little bit of right wing competition. But if they are going to like make a grab at the playoffs, it feels like Sentner and Mazingo are both players that really need to produce pretty quickly, because they are the ones that seem to offer the most creative potential, which of course we don't know if it's going to be realized yet.
I think Hannah Bedford's probably a nailed-on starter, if only for the lack of other alternatives there.
Yeah.
Can I throw a hypothetical out?
Oh, we love those.
That's literally the entire podcast.
What does their attack look like if you assume that Onamanu is the nine? On her.
As the nine rather than pulling wide?
Yeah. And she's like, just run the channels and like be the vertical stretcher, and like you're gonna push back lines back with your pace that way, and it's gonna be very like early 2010s 4-3-1 with like, I don't know, Sentner, Mazingo, and like Frankie Taliaferri or something crazy, and just like all rotating and running about and pressing and being crazy. Like, does that move either of you?
I don't know if it moves me.
It moves Onamanu a lot.
It does move Onamanu a lot, and I like the idea because they are gonna need to, you know, maybe I don't know if Bedford is gonna be quite the player with the physical profile that can do that to like muscle center backs around. So
I think the thing with Bedford that's gonna be really hard is like there's no way she's gonna go 90.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I don't see her being a player who's like going to stay on the pitch as a striker for 90 minutes. Right. So you need. Whether, and maybe that's like Mozingo becomes a stretching nine, which like she was not really in college, but like we see players change roles all the time.
Right.
To me, it's just like, I feel like we are missing something about how they want to play based on how the talent is there. And maybe the answer is they're just going to play a certain style suboptimally. Mm-hmm. But it is kind of a fun puzzle. And I don't know how much faith I have in A-Rod to like, find the right way to put those puzzle pieces together perfectly.
And she's such a tough hang with the press, man. Like, you just never know whether she is going to be smiles and cheer or like be ready to bite your head off.
Here's actually the other thing that, and again, I don't know if this is necessarily a good thing, but when I think about what one wants out of an expansion team, what I really like is the hypothetical that you've posed. Amy Rodriguez actually has a long enough leash to try a lot of different things to see what sticks. And if she is willing to go back to the drawing board every week after and sort of just learn on the job in season and really be critical and keen and have a keen eye toward what is and is not working, she has the right kind of environment to put lots of the different in-between players that she has in a lot of different variations. And maybe something does click along the way. Mm. I don't think that's a knowable entity now. And I don't think it's a particularly likely outcome, but she certainly has the rope to do that in a way that lots of other coaches in this league won't.
Yeah.
She doesn't have the expectation of like coming at, I certainly hope she doesn't have the expectation of coming out and just like making the playoffs year one.
She did say that she was hoping for a championship this year.
Well, I want a panda.
But she caveated it with like, but we're also realistic. It's very difficult to do as an expansion team, as if that's the only thing holding them back.
How much rope do you think she has? Just as like a meta conversation.
I think she survives year one. I mean, you don't hire a coach that far out.
What's the line where she doesn't survive?
What, Evan, Sky Blue, 9 points? 8 points?
Yeah, Sky Blue 2018, 9 points. Yeah, if they're at eight.
That was a lot fewer games, right?
If they're at 8 points or below, then maybe that's what happens.
But beyond that, man.
Yeah.
All right.
Predictions. Where do we think they're going to finish?
I'm going to go 12th. I don't think they'll come last. I think
you are the optimist in the group.
I think someone, I don't think they'll be very good, but I think someone will like I think there's a chance like Orlando are pretty bad. I think Houston will be pretty bad. But I think, yeah, they'll like fluke their way to being slightly better than the worst team in the league. What a kind thing to say.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I mean, I think Eric and I are in agreement it's going to be 14th.
Yeah, 14th. I look at every other roster in this league and I can't.
Yeah. Wow, we talked a lot more about this team than I thought we would.
So, Evan, to paraphrase Amy Rodriguez, who would like a title but knows it's hard, to take us from one team that I think probably doesn't have a great shot at a title to another team that I think all of us are quite bullish about as an expansion franchise. And maybe title's too far, but maybe title isn't too far.
We are, of course, talking about Bay FC, and now that we are the official women's soccer podcasting partner of ASA, we do need to make a little bit of a disclosure right at the top of the show and say that former ASA podcaster and writer Ariel Dror is the director of data analytics at Bay FC. That is important for you to know. But we like to think that we have a really good eye for talent, and Ariel's just better than everybody. And so that's why this team is going to be so good.
Well, I think in the profile of what we've seen so far, this is very clearly a team that values analytics.
Yeah.
Lucy Rushton is a former analytics person. You have Austin Buchanan from formerly of Louisville, who has like long been someone engaging with ASA and with the analytics community in North America. Ariel has been around, was at Zealous before, who work with Redbird, who own AC Milan and Toulouse, who like revolutionized Toulouse from a second division team to a Europa League team in 3 years. Like, this is clearly an organization that like top to bottom has valued analytics, and you can see it in the signings. You look at Kunananjan and Oshwala, who are like just stats monsters.
Yes. Yeah.
Stats monsters. So I think like we are very right to be.
Well, excited. And I think also it's not just that they have given Rushton, Buchanan, and Dror a lot of room to move in shaping this roster construction. It should also be said, and this is really the truth, when anybody tries to say that, you know, analytics can, you know, Moneyball is a long-term and sustainable solution to be a winner. It's money. And Sixth Street Investors, who are the real owners of this team, not Daniel Slayton or Allie Wagner or the other U.S. national team veterans who are the face of the ownership group, it's private equity money coming out of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. They have made a very legitimate and very substantial financial commitment to the team that, even though Utah had all the same opportunities to spend the same amount of money being an expansion team with extra allocation cash, having a doubled salary cap coming into 2024, having the ability to sell expansion draft protection in order to get more allocation money or players or other draft picks, Bay is actually putting its money where its mouth is and are opening up the checkbook. I mean, the world record transfer signing is Rachel Kunananji, whose contract is also going to put her in like top five women's best paid women's players in the league, in the world right now.
I think they're the only club who hit that like gated transfer fee, the new transfer fee rule. I think they're the only club in NWSL who hit it.
Yeah, and because they have stashed away so much allocation money, their cap hit and their fines for that are going to be substantially reduced.
Yeah.
So it's one of the things that when Castellanos and Oshwala and Kunananji just started all rolling in as their big signings, Eric and I just kept saying, isn't it remarkable that they blew a bunch of money on a bunch of big-name superstars, and it does not seem as though this is just going to be a win-now-and-rebuild-in-2-year situation? You know, these are actually a group of players that feels potentially sustainable for quite a long time.
I just look at this team and I say, you know, 6-7 weeks ago when I was at the draft, it was, I said this earlier with Evan, it was like one could have reasonably made an argument about which team was better suited as the expansion team on draft night. 6 weeks from now, that is not a question. The signings that Bay have unveiled piece by piece make sense to me, not only as individual high producing stat monsters, but like together they make a lot of sense to me. They seem to be like really well suited to like Kunananj and Oshwala is like a devastating 1-2 up top. I look, Castellanos is devastating. Like, it's just, I look at this team and I think you basically just crushed the short, medium, and long-term planning to be a team in this league that is competing for titles for years and years to come. And, like, you're going to be throwing on a team that, like, can immediately challenge, like, not only as a playoff team, but can immediately challenge for a title in its first year.
Let's start at the beginning with the hiring of a general manager like Rushton.
Yeah.
Who I don't know personally. I don't know if you do, Kieran, or know her on any level. But with her history, both in Europe and with DC United, and with somebody who you do know very, very well, Kieran, Ariel, you know, teams who drive a lot of their roster decisions via analytics don't all do it in the same way. So from your perspective as someone who knows somebody on the inside and don't have to disclose any specific confidences, but knowing Ariel the way that you do and knowing Rushton's reputation from her past appointments, how have they used analytics to build this team? What have they been chasing? And what do they think they want this team to look like ultimately?
No, I haven't had conversations with Ariel about what they're specifically doing with their team, but like, it's one of those things that when you think about what analytics brings to an organization, right? As much as it's like, we're going to target players with good XG. Like, yes, that's one side of it. Like, you're not going to buy this striker because she had a hot finishing season. You're looking at like a legitimate sample size. But a lot of it is like a probabilistic or an analytical state of mind from like a decision-making perspective. Like, mm-hmm. We want to play soccer this way. Well, why do we want to play soccer this way? Like, they have said we want to play like Barcelona because we think it's the best way to play soccer to win. They're an analytical club. I bet you they're going to care a lot about set pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you look, they have set piece sharples on their squad who averages one set piece shot every single game. And it's like, okay. So that I think is like, there's things there. And I think a thing that you're really going to see with this team is as they play and get data about their own players, I think you're going to start to see a lot of really savvy moves that we maybe don't see. Like the thing that comes to mind that you see smart analytical organizations do every time is like they sell high on players who are having a hot season that they know are not this good. So I think if you see like, I don't even know who's a good example because like they're not going to sell on Ashuala or Kundinanji, but like
Scarlett Camberos, I think if she's healthy for the start of the season is a good example.
If Scarlett Camberos has like a really hot year or Tess Bode or Kiki Pickett or something like that have like a really hot season that is kind of out of character for them, like I wouldn't be shocked if they're like, hey, Boston coming into NWSL, yeah give us $300,000 and protection and we'll give you this player. Right. And it's like, well, we know they're not a $550,000 player.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's where I think you'll see it manifest the most.
Yeah, Bode and Pickett are actually two really good candidates for that because my preferred formation for this team would have Kiki Pickett starting at left back just because I would rather have Dorian Bailey in the midfield than Joel Anderson. But if Pickett has a lot of technical skill that hasn't really produced much in her travels in the NWSL. So what
I will say about left back is I think it is almost certain that Savvy King is going to play left back.
Really?
Wow.
She's played left back like all of preseason. I've been watching those Instagram fan group streams.
What a curveball, because we have been trying to figure out how all these four starting 11 capable center backs that they have on their team right now would be deployed. And what you're suggesting is that, well, you can get three of them on the field at the same time. Never occurred to me.
I was unaware of this, but apparently Savvy King was a left back before she went to college.
Aha. Okay.
But is naturally a left back. That's what the Twitters are saying.
The Twitters. Interesting. So very interesting.
I love that. And I love that because it is an overwhelming experience to jump from the college to the pro game. But left back is a position that is, generally speaking, one where your set of instructions, wingback, fullback, are a lot less complex than other positions on the field. And to bet in an elite talent with a lot of promise, but giving them clear directives in that position and not putting them in places where they can make critical errors that there isn't anybody behind them for, I think that's flipping fucking brilliant to put Sabby King at left back, because I think it just, like, it maximizes her opportunity to be a contributor in this team while not actually hurting, you know, like, while solving the depth issue that we'd been looking at. That's great.
So I think there's, like, a couple really interesting wrinkles to that, and more to their fullback choices in general. If you look at the players they have who can play fullback, you've got Kiki Pickett, you've got Dorian Bailey, you've got Tedesco, you've got Sabby King. And it's like all of those players are interesting, but you have, like, Tedesco spent some time at center back. Like, she played outside center back in Houston a lot. Sabby King played outside center back in college all the time. So, like, is it going to be one of those things where you're going to have a back four that becomes a three in possession? And you're going to defend with 3+1 or 3+2 to defend transitions. And it's a big thing for me where they talk about, we want to be Barcelona, we want to play attacking, we want to play aggressive. And you have a coach whose biggest success was winning a title like 15 years ago almost.
With Gold Pride.
Where, like, soccer was a totally different thing. Like, rest defense wasn't a thing people talked about 15 years ago.
Right. Especially in the women's game.
Yeah, so I have so many questions about how they're going to play, where they say, we're going to be this, we're going to be this, we're going to be this. And not to take this too far a different direction, but I think one of the things that makes me so high on Bay is that if Utah try and play launch and squish and it doesn't work, I don't see what they're going to do. I don't see a route to them playing anything else. If Bay try and play and it doesn't work, look at their talent. If they're like, we're going to play a 4-4-2 and we're going to park it and we're going to kick it to the two fastest players in the league.
Yeah. It's like, oh, what a shame. Oh, we got to play long balls to Asisat Oshwala.
Exactly.
Cry me a goddamn river.
Exactly. So, like, I think for them, the floor of, like, oh, this went terribly is like, we can defend 4-4-2 in a mid block and ruin you on the counter. And that, I think, is a very, very valuable thing.
Yeah. Completely, especially if, as you say, because another part of trying to figure out the back line is, does Jen Beatty start alongside Emily Menges or is it Kayla Sharples? And your set piece point is extremely well taken, because Beatty is not as efficient in that area as Sharples is.
I wonder how much she's a play or like a, we need some adults in the room.
That might be true, because this is a fairly young 11. Broadly speaking, Tedesco and Emily Menges are in their 30s. Caitlin Rowlandson is going to be in her age 30 season. But Beatty is not an NWSL veteran in her 30s. She's an Arsenal veteran, and that's a very different attitude. I could see that, because she wasn't able to get minutes once Leah Williamson and, you know, that core of that central defense came back and was able to play as a unit. So she had to go somewhere, so maybe that was the pitch. Like, you get to play in a really nice place of part of the world, and, you know, you'll get a decent paycheck, and we just need you to be the den mother in the locker room. I could see that.
So I think we are all, and we can go further into the lineup, but I think we're all really high on this team. And we've talked about this team on the pod previously, sort of with increasing levels of excitement. Tell me why this won't work.
I have a really good one.
Yeah. I really want to hear, what is the thing that makes you, that gives you pause with Bay?
I think they're really thin.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Like, I think they have legitimate squad depth issues. Like, I think if one of the two big attackers go down, like, you are awfully dependent on the other one. And this is a thing, like, people have talked about in the NBA, like, having a third star insulates you against one of them going down. Like, I think they are extremely not insulated against that. Especially in midfield.
Rachel Hill ends up getting a lot of minutes as a winger. That's a problem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what gives me pause, number one, is I think they're just very thin. And I think, like, their depth is like a lot of betting on like, what is Maya Doms going to give right. you? And like, I'm a little bit less high on Maya Doms. Like, I think her college data was a little bit worse than what her like public perception was, but maybe she hits, like, I don't know. So I think that's one thing. The other thing is like tremendous question marks about goalkeeping.
Mm-hmm.
Like if Utah have huge question marks as well, but they have like Katie Rowland has been like career backup who's not really played very much.
Her numbers, you know, ASA's goalkeeping numbers are great for her, but she played 200 minutes. Yeah. And
exactly.
Even 2,000 minutes isn't enough to tell you what a goalkeeper really is.
Yeah, we did a cool article this summer with Mike and Bergio where we looked at if you treat goalkeeping using some like Bayesian statistics and the short version of it is you can see like if a goalkeeper is this good, how many shots against them do you need that you can tell for sure in the data? And if you're a 99th percentile goalkeeper, you can tell in about 2 seasons worth of data.
Mm-hmm.
99th percentile. So that means you are like God. Mm-hmm.
Right.
If you are a 75th percentile, which is still really good, you need like 5 or 6 seasons of data.
Jesus. Yeah.
And that's like,
it's worthless at that point.
Yeah, so it's really, really, really hard to tell when you're talking about these G divided by XG numbers or G minus XG numbers. So keep that in mind. But I think, yeah, Katie Rowland, like, there just isn't really the, like, maybe she's good, maybe she's not.
Yeah.
And then the other is that they went and got Lucienne Poole, the Canadian goalkeeper who's playing in Australia, who had, like, really interesting numbers in Portugal, I think. We have very limited data what we can see on Y-Scout, and it's like, okay, this is interesting. I think she came down to earth a little bit in Australia, but again, is like young goalkeeper who played for like a pretty bad team in college, is really small. I'm a former goalkeeper. I'm also Canadian, so I'm contractually obligated that I have to like her. So there are things I do like. She's excellent at 1v1s, like genuinely a legitimate, super good 1v1 stopper. So good that I'm like, are they going to play a stupid high line and be like, yeah, save the 1v1s? And she's very good with her feet in like a, I'm willing to play, not so much a, like I can play.
Mm. Yeah, I think also it feels to me like maybe the first choice backup after Roland is probably Melissa Lauder, for no other reason that like you have at least some information on her as to how she performs in a training environment in the NWSL, even though she's never really gotten a game there.
I don't know if who will be, like, again, this is another one where, like, I'd love more visibility into preseason because, mm-hmm, like, right. I'm sure Rowland has been the starter in preseason, but if she's been stinking it up, like, I think it might be open. It's not like there's a clear starter there who's, like, this is their role to lose.
Right.
A goalkeeper that I was, like, super vocal about that just retired instead of signing for Bay is Emily Boyd from Chicago, who's had, like, way better numbers than Rowland and like much more sample size, not amazing sample size, but at least has like 30 to 40 games worth and just like, yeah, I'm not playing soccer anymore, which is crazy. But,
Oh, especially in this era when like she could make a living doing it. Yeah, I think your point is extremely well taken. I think that we've already seen it, right, with Rachel Kundinunji getting her knee injured during Olympic qualifiers with Zambia, and we haven't been able to get any clear answers as to, like, the severity of that injury. And it's great to have Oshuala there and use her as the point person, but also, you know, Scarlett Comberos was injured with Mexico. We don't know her status yet. If Oshuala really is the only attacking option on the field during a starting 11, it's much easier for that player to get triple teamed knowing that there probably isn't another goal scoring option around her.
This is another thing. I don't know if you've been paying attention to like preseason starting 11s. Oshuala hasn't played yet.
Right.
Castellanos hasn't played yet.
Right.
Kundinunji hasn't played yet. That's a lot of like, that's three locked in starters who are like, hey, your first game is in like, 14 days? Like,
less, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
As
of this release, like a day or two.
Yeah, like you kind of need them for preseason. Yeah. Like you actually have nothing to insert them into.
Yeah.
What I like about what they've done, even if there's slow on the uptake, is that each of those players is of a quality on their own that one can sort of they've demonstrated that even at a reduced output, you plug them in and you've still got a very good player, even if they haven't like fully uptaken the system. And then they have somebody like Alex Loera, who's like going to provide offensive continuity.
Oh yeah.
Like I just feel like service is not going to be a problem for this team. And, you know, Kunde Nanji debatably doesn't even need very much service. Like, just will go and get the ball. We'll do everything. But Oshuala has a lot of people who will be providing excellent service to her from many different positions. And as a career excellent finisher, the worst case scenario for this team, even if they're slow on the uptake and they have a not great first 2-3 months, it just still feels like any of that can be... There's remedies in the summer transfer window, and then the team has all the talent that we've already thought about, and now they're seasoned and can really, on the back half of the season, especially in a league with this much parity, just take some scalps.
Yeah, and it can't be emphasized enough that with 8 playoff spots and everything sort of resetting for the tournament once it starts, that means you can't, like, you know, Orlando and Gotham had slow starts last year, and Orlando didn't make the playoffs, but they were close. And then Gotham ended up winning a title. So there is that to consider. I mean, what do we think? Is this a 4-3-3 with Loera, Bailey, and Castellanos in the midfield, Oshuala on the right, Camberos on the left?
I mean, unless it doesn't work, in which we... I take Kieran's point that essentially, like, the level of analytics that are on the way in which they analyze this game, they will be tinkering and figuring out and optimizing constantly and looking to optimize constantly. But I like your day one lineup, by the way, as a 4-3-3. I think that's probably right for me.
If it's a 4-3-3, who is your third midfielder? If you presume that Loera and Castellanos are in midfield, who's your third midfielder and who's the third player in the front three?
I think it's Bailey in the midfield because she's done it before. Just because she was, you know, she got moved out to fullback last year because the Washington was thin at fullback depth. So I think you can play Bailey probably as an 8 to link Loera to Castellanos.
Do you think that midfield is a little bit lightweight?
I think I have said this on the show before, that I think that they are probably one central midfielder shy, but I have a lot of confidence in the way that Loera and Castellanos can build up together, that it might not be as big of an issue as it might be with other squads.
My like questions about the midfield are less... In possession, I have zero doubts about Loera as a 6. I think she's awesome. I think as a play opener, I think you can do some really cool things where like she rolls out wide, especially if you have Xavi King at fullback, where like they don't really have like a drop, collect the ball and dribble winger. So like Loera can roll out and you can do lots of really, really fun things. That I'm not worried about. I do think she's not an amazing defender in terms of like, I'm going to cover lots of ground and break things up. And like, I think she's like way better in transition than people think because she's like sneaky and can foul. But I don't think she's like that destroyer.
Yeah. She's not Jalen Howell.
No, no.
That's right.
Again, she doesn't have to be like, there are 3 players on the planet, like Jalen Howell. It's like Jalen Howell and Lena Oberdorf and nobody else. But
yeah.
I think like that to me is the one I look at and I'm like, man, that's like not a big midfield. And it's not a, like, super defensively talented midfield. So, like, maybe they play, like, Didasco and Xavi King as their fullbacks, and they go nowhere. They don't go. And there's constructions to come up with that. But I do think that's a thing, like, I will be very curious to see what Albertine is coming up with in terms of midfield construction.
Yeah, and then your second question, I think it's probably Camberos if she's healthy, and if not, it's probably Bodie.
Yeah, I think it's been. I think Camberos has been starting or was starting before the international break, like the first couple of reasons.
Yeah,
but I don't. I don't know. I would assume it's Camberos, but I think Bodhi is like that spark plug off the bench is like real exciting.
I think that's well put. I also think that like in a 3-front with Camberos, Oshuala, and Kunde Nanji, like you can rely on Camberos to pull centrally off the wing, open up some space for overlaps, and just kind of drag defenders around and like kind of do a lot of the dirty work that will give Oshuala and Kunde Nanji enough room to be free because you want them to be running into space and getting into good areas. So even if Camberos is not like a massive contributor from like an XG or an X assist point of view, I think there is value to be had there with her on the left.
Can I give you a really left field lineup?
Dude, that's what this show is for.
So here's my really, really left field idea.
All right.
I think they should lean into the soccer ball. I think they should abandon these visions of Barcelona.
Oh, man.
And I
think here we go.
I think that they should play
Galaxy Brain.
A 4-3-1-2.
Ariel is never going to speak to you again.
No, probably not. Or a diamond, and put Castellanos behind Kandanji and Oshuala, and defend with 7 and attack with 3, and win every game 1-0 off of the counter goal they score.
So I actually pitched a version of this, maybe a little bit more box midfieldy than what you're suggesting, but
you could get box midfieldy if you went with like if Maya Doms is like more interesting than I expect there to be, right. Like where it's like very like Bundesliga 4-2-2-2 empty bucket type deal.
Mm-hmm.
But I think like because I just have this weird. So I got into women's soccer like. Castellanos had left college soccer by the time I got it. I started following.
She was already with Atletico Madrid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, it's not like La Liga Femme was like super accessible here to watch.
Not at all.
So my experience with Castellanos is like mostly Man City Castellanos, who is a super weird player.
Yeah. And one that Gareth Taylor didn't trust very much.
Yeah. So she was often like shunted wide or was like playing deep and like had no attacking input. So like part of me is like I want to mitigate the risk here and just play them three and leave me alone and go score goals and create goals and have fun and we'll defend and you guys go do this.
Yeah, I mean it's fair. I think also that's it's such a well balanced because Oshuala and Kundinanji, I think if they're the only striker in the system, like they're gonna be the act, they're gonna be the striker. They're not gonna be wanting to do any sort of like wide dribble take on shit. So to like use Kundinanji as someone who can like drop deeper, potentially link up, use Castellanos to like push in past her, have Oshuala being the player running off the shoulder is cool. It might not be, as you say, it might not actually be all that pretty until those players are actually putting the ball in the back of the net, but I don't hate that.
I had someone once describe NWSL to me as a transition fuckfest.
Yeah.
And I think those players are well positioned to thrive in that environment.
I strongly agree with that take. I actually wanted to say this earlier is like everybody's got a plan until somebody punches you in the face, and that often happens with coaches' preseason declarations, to put it kindly. And you're absolutely right. We're also in this very interesting moment in the league where so many new coaches are coming in and so many of them want to move away from such a transitional focus and really keep the ball on the deck and play between the lines and create triangles. And so often in the past, that has been a very rude lesson that coaches have had to learn. And so, you know, will Fran Alonso learn that the hard way in Houston? Will Bev Yanez learn that the hard way in Louisville? Although Yanez is probably, you know, more suited to a transition philosophy, given her history in the league. You know, will Juan Carlos Amoros be able to repeat the success of last season?
Giraldez.
Oh, God, Giraldez is going to be, you know, Giraldez is, it kind of makes me think, like, he's the one that I'm like, you might be Pep coming to City, where you, like, have your one bad year is that you finish third, you know, and you are annoyed in the press that everybody is like just trying to win the second balls and that's all they do and blah, blah, blah. And then you just end up destroying the league in your second year. That's, you know, and we're going to talk about it when we get into the Washington Spirit section of the show later this week. But he's the one that I feel like maybe he can make it work. But I think a lot of these other coaches, you're right, they might get a very, very rough wake-up call a few weeks into the year.
There's something I really like about the suggestion that potentially the most efficient, the running against or like swimming against stream in this league is actually to play suffer ball. And that like there is an inefficiency to be exploited with, particularly with the talent on hand at bay, to play a very unattractive brand of football with two very elite goal scorers at the top. And like, frankly, it's not the crazy, like, it's sad, but maybe it's also kind of the new hipster football. Everyone is, the league is a league going in, there is a trend of a way to play in this league. And if you want to disrupt what is going on in this league, maybe suffer ball is the answer on some level.
4-4-2 used to be cool. It was 60 years ago, but it did used to be cool.
But also, Kieran, you grew up like with Mourinho Chelsea, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I just wanted to put that out there.
No, I am a Chelsea fan who has Chelsea have historically won playing like either defensive possession is how they won the Champions League under Tuchel. They win the Champions League in 2012 playing like legitimately the worst soccer you've ever seen. Like that's the Emma Hayes wins everything, goes into every big game playing the most horrific 4-4-2 long ball.
Literally going to say, yeah.
Which, by the way, I am so excited for American fans to like clock into the first time the U.S. play like Spain or something. And it's like the most miserable 4-4-2 you've ever seen. And it's just long balls to Sophia Smith and like Trinity Rodman. Oh, and everybody's like, what is going on? Anyways, that'll be really fun. But I do think there's like an interesting meta point to be made about like in a league that has tremendous parity, but is also a league that has like tremendous financial dominance over the rest of global women's soccer. Like where can you find like free money?
Yeah.
Where can you find value? And I think maybe it is like, we're going to play a unique way because we can get access to players. Like I have long thought that like broke teams should play a back three because outside center backs and wing backs are way cheaper than good fullbacks or good center backs. So like maybe there is a thing in NWSL that like, hey, if everyone's going to try and play, we should try and not play.
Yeah, that's very well taken because again, so many teams are just in the same stylistic groove. And you know, we talked a lot about in past episodes, like what if Ali Krieger doesn't clear that ball off the line on the last day of the regular season and Gotham doesn't win a title? What does that mean?
I want to give one Gotham take since I will not be on the Gotham episode, but I want to give one Gotham take.
All right, go for it.
They were a team who made all their money pressing last year and they just signed a bunch of old players who don't want to press.
Uh-huh.
I have concerns. Anyways, that's my one Gotham take.
Yeah, I mean, they do a lot of other things pretty very well. So, okay, so predictions, I think that, you know, Eric and I might be a little bit higher on Bay's final table position than Kieran is. So
I don't know. I think Kieran thinks this suffer ball is going to kill the league.
Well, so Kieran, start it off. Where do you think they're going to finish?
Fourth or fifth. I think they're just going to be too thin and like, I think they're come the dog days of July.
Yeah,
and
that's fair.
The Olympic break is going to be very weird. Like, I don't know what that's going to look like because then there's Challenge Cups going on. But I think they're going to struggle for depth and they'll be like fringe home playoff game.
Yeah. Eric?
I'd waffled a lot about sort of where I wanted to place them because I think I got real high on the Kundinagi signing. I mildly prefer the problems of a successful Portland team from last season to a team that has not played together yet, but I see Bay FC as better than just the assemblage of talent that they have, depth aside. I see them as probably better than San Diego and or Washington, so I have them third.
I have them second, and I totally hear, and I've been thinking the whole time, even since the Kundinagi signing, that like, yeah, the downfall of this team is depth. Like, if there is just one too many injuries in the 11, they really could run into a lot of problems pretty quickly. But at the same time, this is a really, really elite group of players that, when healthy, can bank points. And I think that a prediction that high could really come to bite me in the ass. I was talking to somebody in the press box during USA Colombia in the quarterfinals of the Gold Cup, and he says, like, yeah, I think like eighth or ninth is where Bay FC is finishing. And that feels like very, very pessimistic just based on the talent that they've assembled at this point. I mean, I think you're right. It's depth and depth alone that really could bring them down. But man, if this 11 is humming all at the same time, it's going to be really, really scary.
Kieran, you got any other you got any other hot takes you want to spit about the league? Because this is your big opportunity preseason.
The only hot take that I have is that I think NWSL is going to lean into their global financial dominance. And I think the next 2 years of transfers are going to be scary, scary good. I think there's going to be a lot of big, big names that are convinced by very large paychecks to come to NWSL.
And that hasn't always been the case in the league. This is a brand new phenomenon that is just beginning to flower this offseason, and I think you're right. And especially now with, as you said earlier in the episode, so many more markets that are appealing irrespective of the paycheck. You know, San Francisco, LA, San Diego, you know, it doesn't have to just be Portland anymore. Washington, you know, if Washington actually hits this year with Giraldes, like, that's another one where you could see players starting to flow, especially with what Michelle Gong wants to do with that squad. So, yeah, they're right. Yeah, no, you're smart. You're smart, Kieran.
Yeah. Way no, we enjoyed.
Way to go. Hey, this is you know, as the fellow once said, I believe this is the start of a beautiful friendship, and your last name certainly suggests I gotta like you. So we are more than thrilled to be part of the ASA family going forward for this 2024 season, Kieran. And thank you so much for coming on and helping to kick off NWSL preseason preview week with us.
Thank you for having me on. I think we're all very excited at having another show on the feed. I think people are going to be happy to have a break from myself, Harrison, and Ben, and have a little bit nicer audio quality for sure. Definitely keep tuning in.
So yeah. We are going to be back every single day this week leading up to the Challenge Cup between Gotham and San Diego on Friday, previewing the 12 remaining teams we still have yet to plow through. A lot of great guests coming up. Throughout the season, you're going to be hearing Kieran pop up as he is inclined to join us and chat. So look forward to him. And in the meantime, you know, read everything that is being written on AmericanSoccerAnalysis.com. I've got a few previews for the NWSL season up there, and I think hopefully if Eric can find the time, he might contribute something.
I have no time.
I didn't say now. I said, you know,
the previews will be there. The previews
in the grand scheme, in the many months to come.
Oh, no, in the future, yes.
I think there's nobody who writes analytical previews the way ASA does, so check them out. I'm writing San Diego this year, so special eye for that one. But there's a couple stingers in there for sure.
Yeah, yeah, you'll be able to read Ariana's stuff there, and, you know, rate us, review us, follow us on our feed or on ASA's, and be sure to listen to all of ASA's show if you're an MLS fan and if you enjoy American Broso soccer, like I guess some of you do. Be sure to follow us on socials at XOwnGoals, that's the letter XOwnGoals, email us at expectedowngoals@gmail.com, and giddy up, folks, it's going to be a wild ride this season. Can't wait to dig into all of it.
Yeah, you've just listened to three people with Welsh last names give no hot Seattle takes. Those are coming. Trust me.
Cymru, baby.